It's a pleasure to have Chiara Marletto today, all the way from Oxford University. And Chiara is going to tell us about witnessing alone classicality beyond quantum theory. So please, Chiara, go on.
Okay, so thanks for inviting me. So I hope this talk will be fun in the sense that I will be discussing some of these ideas that I, so on the one hand, things that I've been talking about, thinking about for the past few years, and then specifically an application to this issue of witnessing non-classicality in physical systems. And the emphasis in the title is this beyond quantum theory, because one of the things that I'm interested in is to try to generalize these tools that we have in quantum information theory beyond the quantum theory formalism. So the kind of, you know, overall context of this talk is, you know, I'm coming from the quantum information direction and I'm looking at this nice theory that we have, which is quantum information. And I would like to for it to still, even if we were to lose some of the aspects of quantum theory, for instance, its features of its dynamics or features of its formalism, when we transition to the future theory of physics, which will probably merge, you know, quantum theory and gravity. The starting point of this talk should be this problem about hybrid systems. So what I call hybrid system is something that may be a bit different from what, you know, this term has been used a lot in the literature in a sense for defining all sorts of things in different fields. But what I mean here is really this very simple concept that is illustrated here. So you've got a system which is a quantum system such as a qubit, which kind of obeys the laws of quantum theory in full, and you know, we have full quantum control on it, and it interacts somehow with another system, which here I call M, which standard system. So it's a system whose dynamical laws are not known in every detail. So you can think of it as being something for which we have a number of proposed dynamical laws, which we don't know which one to use in the context. Or you can think of it just as, for example, as a macroscopic molecule, which need not obey quantum theory because, for example, it can collapse away from quantum theory, or you know, be a completely classical system, and so on. So you can think of this M as being a very general system, and later, of course, I'll think of it in terms of gravity. But this problem, I consider it as a general problem. And if you think about it, I think this is a key problem in at least in the foundations of quantum information, because we have this theory about quantum information, which is basically based on a model where all unitary interactions are allowed and all quantum states are preparable with perfect accuracy, which is what you can do, let's say, in a quantum computer. But we don't really know to what extent this kind of model applies to real physical systems. And so this is why I'm interested in this kind of hybrid system situation, where some of the usual assumptions of quantum information theory may not be applicable, and still we want to make kind of some predictions about this composite system. And so one specific problem in the context of the problems of hybrid systems is, suppose you can, you know, probe this system M with Q, and suppose that you would like to extract some features of M to conclude whether M has or doesn't have some features of quantum systems. So you would like to probe M and see how much how many of the features of a fully fledged quantum system it has. And so this is the kind of problem that will specialize in the talk. And the question is, imagine you don't want to resort to the usual dynamical laws in order to perform predictions about the system. And imagine you don't want to use certain approximation schemes that may be viable. Is there still a way of making predictions in this context? And so the answer that I will give in this talk is yes. And I'll confine attention to a specific problem, which is what I kind of like to call final think. Of course, the problem was pointed out in various ways, but was Feynman's. So I think he has this interesting conversation with Herman Bondi in the in this historical conference. So it's nice to read the proceeding. We're saying, well, you know, Feynman is kind of considering this situation where you have a kind of superposed mass across two different locations, and like in this, for example, Max Zander interferometer. And then it's kind of considered, you know, if you follow quantum theory, of course, this state is preparable for the mass. And if you follow the theory of gravity that Einstein proposed, then of course there must be an interaction between this mass and gravity. And so what one could call the gravitational field, at least in some approximations, should respond to the mass and somehow interact with it and then evolve into some state. Feynman's point was that, of course, if we go by some quantum gravity model, there should be a moment where the gravitational field is in an entangled state with the mass. And then he was trying to persuade this very skeptical colleague of his, Bondi, who was saying, well, but how do I know that the state of the gravitational field is really quantum? How can I be assured through an experiment that indeed the gravitational field has some quantum features, and how can I distinguish its state, its entangled state with the mass, from a simple statistical mixture of different classical states? And so this problem is an open problem in a sense, and partly also because the models of quantum gravity that we have produce predictions that are very hard to test. And so in this problem situation, I think there was recently a nice suggestion to try to probe this state of the gravitational field and conclude that gravity has some quantum features by somehow bypassing some of these problems that have been affecting all the proposals for testing quantum gravity. So, and so this is the kind of proposal. So the idea is to take the gravitational field, which in this case is the system, probe it with two objects. And of course you can recognize in the two quantum probes are, for example, two masses that can be fully controlled in a quantum way. And so the basic idea of the test is to say that if we start with the two masses in a non-entangled state, and then they interact with gravity in a way that is local, so each mass interacts separately with gravity, but there is no direct interaction between the two masses. And then if at a later point we can see that the two masses become entangled through this interaction with gravity, then you can conclude that actually gravity has to have some quantum features. And these quantum features are not the full range of quantum properties of a fully fledged quantum system, but they are features that we can call non-classical features. So specifically, you can conclude that gravity, or more generally, this system M has to have at least two non-commuting variables. So it has to be described it can't be described just by a single classical observable or by a statistical mixture of its values, but it has to have this non-commutativity in the operators that describe its variables. Now, the test is promising in the sense that than others, and it's kind of promising also because the masses involved are of the order of 10 to minus 12 kilograms, so they are not quite within reach yet, but I think they are more within reach than of course superposing Planck's mass. But what I would like to focus on today is not quite the discussion about the experiment, and I think that there have been lots of interesting follow-up papers since the original ones on this idea. But I would like to focus more on the foundations of the idea, and specifically, I would like to point out the fact that when you make this statement, so you know, you want to say if a system M can entangle two other systems that are fully quantum, then it itself has to be non-classical. That's the kind of statement that we are talking about. We would like to assume the least number of properties of quantum theory as far as M is concerned. So we don't want to prove this result by, say, assuming quantum information, for example, or quantum theory to apply fully to M, because that would be circular in the sense that we need to be, you know, the kind of argument to be more general than that, because we want to use the argument to propose a test that finally can tell us that M has some quantum features. So we don't want to assume that M already obeys a full quantum theory. And ideally, we don't want even to assume features of quantum theory, of the formalism quantum theory, such as density operators, for example, or unitary transformations to describe the states that M can assume and the kind of dynamics that it can undergo. So the question is, can we have a general version of this argument that supports this kind of tests that doesn't rely on results from quantum information theory, but has the same reach as the result that I just said? So can we still prove this statement, the fact that if M can entangle two systems, then it's got to be non-classical, in a more general framework? So the answer is yes, but in order to talk about, you know, why I think the answer is yes, I have to introduce a number of things. And so I have to introduce a more general framework to kind of talk about the argument in the first place. So to introduce the framework, I want to kind of consider the fact that the type of argument I'm describing here, the one that I would like to construct and for it to be more general, is an argument that is going beyond quantum dynamics. And one could say, but how can I actually make an argument of that type if I drop features of quantum theory? So what am I going to use in order to make the argument? Well, of course, you know, if you look at physics and the way in which we make predictions, there is a whole other set of things that we usually use in order to make predictions, which are not formulated in terms of dynamics. And these are physical principles. So I put here some examples of physical principles that we are all familiar with. The first two are from thermodynamics. So you got the conservation of energy and the second law of thermodynamics, which are both about forbidding some kind of perpetual motion machines. So they are about certain transformations being impossible. And then there is here on this combinature, which is a more controversial, I would say, conjecture about a possible principle that we might find to hold in our universe, which is the fact that a universal computer is possible. And just for your amusement, so I put this nice cartoon here where, well, there is a kind of pictorial representation of what would have been the first programmable computer in the Victorian era. And this was, you know, something that Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace conjectured. It's called the analytical engine. And it's a fascinating piece of engineering and mathematics as well, where you can see that both of them, especially Ada Lovelace, I think, understood the possibility of this machine to simulate any other physical process that is allowed by the laws of physics, which is something, of course, that then was developed by Turing and by the pioneers of the quantum computer later. But anyway, so I think this is just to summarize the fact that there are other ways of hello? Yes?
Yes, can I ask, you could, it's up to you. Can I ask a question or shall I save it?
Yes, I'm happy if you ask questions. Yeah, please just go ahead.
Okay, Penrose would claim that the fact that we can prove Gödel's theorem means that nature is not computable.
Well, it depends. I think it depends what you mean by computable. I think so Penrose's definition of computability is a mathematical definition, whereas the kind of computability that I'm referring to here, which is, let's say, the one that was then somehow at the base of quantum information, is the fact that it's computable according to whatever laws of physics you have. So if the computability of nature is a feature of those dynamical laws, whereby you can construct a machine in that universe which can be programmed in order to execute all the physically allowed dynamical evolutions. And I think this is a subtly different definition from the definition that from the concept of, let's say, Turing computable. And so, you know, even if you dropped, let's say, the current laws of physics, you know, if you didn't have quantum theory and GR as being the laws, but different laws, you could still define, you could still say that there is computability of nature in the specific universe in question, even though the functions that are being computed in that hypothetical universe are not necessarily Turing computable functions, permutations in the sense that we mean.
Okay, go ahead.
So I on the one hand agree with what Penrose said if I take a narrow definition, but I disagree in general because I think that's not a useful definition for physics. I don't know if my answer made sense.
Sure, if it becomes important. Hello, it's fine, thank you.
Okay, we can maybe discuss this during the questions. Yes. In any case, I don't think this is important for the current talk. So I just put it there because I really like this universality of computation. I think it's a fun property. But yeah, it was mostly for amusing you guys. Sorry, going back to the main point of this talk. So I said I want to generalize this argument and so by looking at this other way of formulating laws of physics, which is using physical principles, you can think of maybe a general framework, a general theory where you could formulate this the argument that we are interested in, which is not based on dynamics. So dynamics is no longer like the primitive entity that you use in order to explain most things, but it's based on physical principles and on these statements about possible and impossible transformations. And so if you kind of follow this train of thought, you will end up with talking about an approach which I've been working on for a few years now, which is called constructor theory. And so this is the constructor theory program in the way that David Deutsch, who originated this approach, I think conceived it, theory, which is then going to be the framework in which I'm going to talk about this general argument, is that the laws of physics are should be expressed as these scale-independent axioms or principles about which tasks are possible, which are impossible, and why. And I'm going to say in a moment what tasks are and what possible and impossible exactly mean. But the important thing is that in this context, in this framework, let's say the principles are somehow the fundamental statements, and then dynamics and the boundary conditions or the supplementary conditions that you use in order to supplement dynamical equations should be obtained from these principles as some kind of emergent consequences. Now, this is a program, so it's something that may or may not work in the long run. But what I found promising in this approach, and the reason why I'm interested in the theory, is that construct theory has a number of kind of newly proposed physical principles, some of which are about information theory, and it's also kind of a way of generalizing the quantum theory of computation beyond quantum theory itself. And this is what I think is very promising in the approach. And this is the way in which I look at it as a very useful set of tools that can be used now in order to, you know, address this problem of hybrid systems and specifically the problem of kind of phrasing this argument for witnessing non-classicality in gravity, general closed. So note that constructor theory, I think there are all sorts of possible confusions about it, you know, starting from the name, as will become clear in a moment. But I think I just want to point out that, as hopefully will also become clear later, the theory has some principles of its own. And so it's not just a mathematical framework in which you can, say, rephrase existing physics. You know, it's a kind of should have a set of conjectured new principles, which should have experimental consequences, and therefore it could be tested, and then, you know, it could be found out to be wrong or not. But so it's a substantially so it's a kind of it has a physical content, this theory. So in brief, I think the main objects of the theory are tasks. So these are sets of ordered pairs of input-output attributes. So this generalizes, this notion of task is a kind of ultimate generalization of the idea of a computation, where you have some input attributes and output attributes. Attributes is just a generalized notion of state. And substrates is a technical term to indicate physical systems on which you can perform tasks. So the tasks can be either possible or impossible. So the task is impossible if there's a law of physics that says it cannot be performed to arbitrarily high accuracy, and if it's possible if there isn't such a limitation to how well it can be performed. So a simple example I think from quantum information is the task of cloning a set of states. So if you have a set of states that are non-orthogonal, the task of cloning them is, of course, impossible because there's a fundamental limitation which is basically imposed by unitarity on the accuracy to which you can clone them. But if they are orthogonal, then the task is possible. And that means we can perform, we can construct arbitrarily accurate gates that implement the cloning task. And then you can think of countless other examples of possible and impossible. And I think if you think about the laws of physics, you will see that these two concepts are much more pervasive than one would think at first, in the sense that most principles we know, including the principles of thermodynamics, the principle of locality, and other principles, are phrased in this sense of either saying that a certain transformation is possible or that it is impossible. And finally, it's important to notice that when I talk about a possible task, I mean something that's very different from physically, dynamically allowed transformation. Hello? Is there anyone asking a question? No.
Is the second law of thermodynamics a principle under this definition of principles or not, because it can be violated? So you cannot do it with arbitrary precision. Second law of thermodynamics is commonly violated if you have a small enough system. It's a probabilistic principle.
Well, yes. So that's a nice question. So the current formulations of the second law are inadequate in the sense that they are not fundamental laws. So they are not, of course there are lots of formulations of the second law, but the traditional ones that we know are approximative, and they are dependent on the scale, and so they don't quite fit into this model of a law. So if you want to
in your language,
sorry, say it again, I didn't catch the start of
it's not a principle to be considered in your language.
Well, it's not a principle formulated according to this constructor theory approach. It's a principle that you can talk about it as an approximative principle if you like, but ideally when I talk about a principle, I want a scale independent one, and one that is therefore exact. So I think the some of the principles we have now in thermodynamics are not quite satisfactory, because they are, you know, in certain domains are very clearly stated. And when you move away from these domains, it's not clear what they say. So you could think maybe there are principles formulated in this way in the domain of applicability that they have, except that for the second law, the domain of applicability isn't clearly stated. Because when you say, let's say, the thermodynamic limit, for example, it's a very imprecise qualification. So it's not clear what is it that it stops applying. And as you say, if you just use a single system, in a sense, the second law is true trivially, in the sense that entropy doesn't, in an isolated microscopic system, delta S is equal to zero. So if you like, you can say it's still valid, the second law, but it's not quite useful, the current one. So in the program of constructor theory, there should be a way of, and I think there is, to upgrade the principles of thermodynamics so that they are scale independent. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, so, yes. So I think I was just going to say that there is this additional point, which is a bit subtle, that when you talk about a possible task, you don't mean, we don't mean so it's not the same as a dynamically allowed transformation. So, one would, for example, think of a dynamically allowed process as being the same as, let's say, a possible task, but it's not. And in fact, in constructor theory, possible and impossible should be considered as primitive concepts, and then the dynamical consequences are sort of derived from them. But if you want to have a model of what possible means in within a certain dynamical law, then you need to introduce this concept of a constructor. And I'll kind of explain it in a second here. So a constructor is approximately is a system that is capable of performing a certain task T when coupled with the substrates of the task, which are prepared in the input states of the task. And the crucial thing is that this entity, the constructor, qualifies as, the entity that can cause the transformation qualifies as a constructor. the transformation again. So it's not enough to be some kind of part of the environment that can enable the transformation to be a constructor. You also have to be able to work in a cycle. So that's what we mean by a task being possible. We mean that there is no limitation to how accurate a constructor you can produce for this task. So if you think again about the example of cloning, when the states are orthogonal, you can think of more and more accurate approximations to a gate, which is the ideal gate to perform the cloning task, and that's the constructor for the task. But as I said, the only moment where we end up discussing which specific constructor can perform which particular task is when you want to unpack the notion of possibility in terms of dynamics. But the theory, constructor theory, is not about constructors. So it's not a theory about constructors, it's a theory about possible and impossible tasks. And the nice thing about this way of looking at things is that you can abstract away the constructor because it works in a cycle. And with it, you also remove the kind of complexity that the constructor itself brings with it. And the statements about tasks being possible and impossible become exact, and in this program they should be scale independent and so on. So this is the general kind of framework. Now I will discuss a few items that appear in this thing called the constructor theory of information, which is like an example of applying this logic to information theory. And the reason why I'm discussing all these things is just because I want to go back to the original problem I had at the start, where I told you that I wanted to have a more general basis to formulate this theorem, which is the basis of these weaknesses of non-classicality in gravity. So, you know, the end point of the talk will be that. So first, let me clarify that so information theory is a perfectly fine branch of initially we thought mathematics, and then we ended up noticing that we can think of it as a branch of physics too. And so, you know, if you think of Shannon's theory or the quantum theory of information later, and various theorems that are being proved in those fields, they are completely fine, and the stuff I'm going to talk about now is actually something that should provide foundations for those fields. So it's not at the level of, let's say, Shannon's theory. What I'm going to discuss now is to provide a physical basis for theories of information. So the key question the transformation address is, what are the regularity needs to have in, say, a set of physical laws for systems that can instantiate information to exist? So, you know, we have an informal concept of what it means for a system to contain information. We can sometimes make a model of what it means in certain physical theories. For example, in quantum theory, you can say, you know, if a system has two orthogonal states, these two can be used in order to encode information. But the more general question that I want to address here is, never mind which particular dynamical laws I'm picking, what are the regularities that I want to have in these laws for systems that can contain information to be able to exist? And this somehow uncovers some kind of regularity in the laws of physics that we have, because to some degree, all the theories of physics that have been working so far are all based on some kind of information. So they all have these features because they all have to be testable, so they have to have observables and so on. So the type of regularities that I'm going to talk about are hopefully a nice kind of set of properties that are good candidates to then be elevated to some sort of principle that we can then use in order to address the problem that I started with. So the key concept in this theory is the concept of an information medium. So an information medium is a physical system with a set of attributes that I call X here, that it is possible to permute and copy. So this is a way of defining a class of physical systems on which certain tasks are possible. And for the sake of getting this right, when I'm talking about copying, I really mean the reversible kind of copy in the sense of computation. So, you know, if you have a set X, which is made of these 1, 2, n, the copy task on X is something that brings a 0 blank state into 0, 0, and 1 blank state is 1, 1, dot, 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 until, you know, you reach n, and then you have n blank state goes to n. And when you have a system which has this property of, you know, having a set of attributes that is permutable in all possible ways and copyable, you call this system an information medium, and X, this variable, is called an information variable. And so an obvious example is a set of n-orthogonal quantum states. But the nice thing is that here you can notice that we're not using any specific bit of, let's say, quantum theory's formalism to talk about an observable. And this is part of why this is useful for the product, because it handles an observable that does not use specific features of the, you know, formal structure of a particular dynamical law that we happen to be using at the moment. So it kind of underlies all the information media that you can define, let's say, within a discretized version of Newtonian physics, and then, let's say, within quantum theory, and perhaps in the successor of quantum theory, and so on. Now, you can formulate a principle of this information media in the sense that, principle in the sense that I said earlier, so a statement about what tasks should be possible in these media. And this principle is called the interoperability principle, and it's basically about, so, you know, you can state it formally by saying that if you combine two information media, each with an information variable x1 and x2, you still get an information medium with the information variable that's a Cartesian product of the two. And so this is like adding some nice algebraic property to this, to these information variable structure. But the informal meaning of the principle is very simple, and it just says what we already informally expect from a good system that can encode information, which is basically that an information variable, one that can be permuted and copied, has to be copyable from any type of information medium to any other. So if you have two different information media that are kind of instantiating two different systems, like a photon and an electron spin, for example, and you put them together, you expect them to still behave jointly as an information medium. Now, this sounds trivial because I'm talking about systems that we already know how they behave, but it's nice to conjecture that this is a regularity that doesn't just hold for the systems we already know how to describe, but holds in general. So this becomes like a guideline for future theories of physics as well, and will be relevant for the argument that I want to construct. So once you have information media, then you can define a subspecies of information media, which we call the super information media. And this is like, so a super information medium is one that has at least two information variables, so two sets of attributes that are permutable in all possible ways and copyable, whose union is not an information variable. And note that this is the definition, again, that only uses constraints on possible and impossible tasks. So an example of a super information medium is a qubit with two complementary variables, like the X and Y components of the spin, for example. Because if you take the union of these two sets, you will see that although each one of them is copyable, the union isn't. And again, because of unitarity, we know it's not. And so what turns out is that by considering the principles of information media and the properties of super information media, you can show that quantum systems are a special case of super information media. So, and also that super information media have all the qualitative properties of quantum systems. So you can then construct like a hierarchy of systems where you have classical information media, which are like this red diagram here. And then like super information media are a subset of this set. And quantum systems are just like one dot inside the super information media set of possibilities. But the exciting thing is that in this framework, you can talk about both classical and quantum information jointly without any approximation. So you don't need, for example, to do any classical limit type procedure to get classical systems, classical information systems out of quantum ones, which are these guys. And also it's a bit different from the usual classification because sometimes we think of quantum systems as a generalization of classical systems. Information theoretic properties, turns out that the classification goes this way, where in fact super information media are a subset of the set of media that can contain information. Okay, so armed with all of this, yes.
Just a bit here. A classical system, I know what is a classical system if I think of a classical pendulum, or if a classical field or a classical particle, and I know some quantum system, but what do you mean here? Because you're talking in general, and in particular, let me give you a specific example. Suppose I like the Debreu Boehm.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can make two claims. One is that my theory is quantum theory, is completely equivalent to quantum theory.
Yes.
But also, my theory doesn't have any of the funny things that we usually attribute to quantum theory because of the formalism. Doesn't have anything like orthogonal states in that sense, or because of just a particle moving around in a wave and equations of motion for this and nothing fancy. So would that be count of classical or quantum, or how can the same thing be? I'm confused. What do you mean by quantum? That's a question.
Yes. Well, quantum systems just means quantum in the sense of it's just quantum theory. The Broglie-Bohm is a variant of, I mean, it's a variant of quantum. So quantum theory are very different from the ontology of quantum theory itself. So in this case, I would say that, so just to answer the first question that you asked, what counts as a classical system in this context? As I said, this is a very specific notion of classicality. It's a system that has at least one variable which is fully copyable and doesn't have other variables whose union with the first one ends up not being copyable. So the information media contain both quantum systems and classical systems that can contain information, as you can see from this diagram.
Well, right, but that's just specific. The Debreu Boehm, yeah. Is a classical theory or quantum theory for you?
Well, unfortunately, it violates the principle of locality in the way that we define it. So it doesn't actually count as...
yet. And you have defined what you haven't talked about locality. Have you?
Well, I haven't because this is not, yes. I mean, locality is one of the assumptions of the theory because you need locality in order to, in order to have information. That's what comes out of this kind of analysis. And I didn't mention it because this is it's a very summarized description of what I've been doing. But I think it's a nice question because it goes at the heart of one of the issues with the Broglie-Bohm, which is that if you take the ontology of the Broglie-Bohm and the particular the particles that are used in order to somehow explain the wave function behavior, then I mean, there's a lot of literature on this, but I think the upshot is that there is a problem with locality in a sense. So I think if you think of just the phenomenology of the Broglie bomb is the same as quantum theory, in that sense, it has information variables. But then if you look at the ontology, there are some kind of very sharp differences. And then the question that's interesting maybe to ask there, and I don't know the answer, is could you define information variables in the, in for the particles? And my guess is not, because they have these properties that somehow violate the principle of locality in the sense that we mean. So it's a nice question. I think it would be nice to look into the Broglie bomb and see how it fits, whether it is in this circle here or it actually doesn't fit. But I think the question, the more general question you asked was, what counts as a quantum system and what counts as a classical system? And I think here I'm trying to move away from the standard distinction between quantum and classical that we have, let's say, based on the dynamical theories that we know. And I'm trying to offer a different classification, let's say, based on the possibility of copying certain sets of states of the systems that are ruled by the specific dynamical laws. And helpful because it takes us a bit further than let's say just thinking of, for example, classical physics as a limiting case of quantum theory, in certain, taking the limit in a certain appropriate way and so on.
Lee had a comment. Does that make
sense? No, it's a side argument, so let's delay it. If it's not relevant to your.
Yeah, okay. We can discuss this later as well. So going back to just to make the final points of this lecture. So in this framework, you can then talk about non-classicality. Instead of talking about the fact that certain variables of the system don't commute, which is what we would do in using quantum theory type of ideas, we can say the system is non-classical if it has an information variable, say Z, and another disjoint variable X, which can be copied simultaneously to perfect accuracy together with Z. And then we call X and Z incompatible, and you can see obviously that this generalizes the idea of non-commuting variables of quantum theory, but again, it does so without using the formalism of quantum theory. And this is why we can then kind of go back to the theorem that I outlined at the start, that I wanted to make more general, and prove it again, let's say in this framework though, with this more general set of assumptions. So there are two principles that we need in order to kind of prove the argument, sorry, prove the theorem. The first is a locality in the form of no action at a distance, which is kind of a nice broad principle that we expect is obeyed by kind of the theories that we currently think are good theories of nature. And then we have the interoperability of information, which is this copyability of information, the principle that I just mentioned earlier. And now if you assume these two general principles and the notion of non-classicality that I just said a slide before this one, you can prove this theorem that somehow with an argument which is dynamics independent and based only on the superinformation framework, that if M is an information medium that can locally mediate entanglement between two quantum media Q and Q primed, then M is non-classical. And now you might kind of think that this is the same as what I said at the start, but it's not, because now we are stating the theorem and the argument that is used in order to prove the theorem in a fully theory, dynamics independent. So the argument now becomes more robust because it's based on these more general. So let me just summarize the basic kind of pluses of this way of putting the theorem. So the first nice thing is that the mediator is characterized in this theory independent, in this dynamics independent way, and the principles that underlie the theorem are also formulated in a similar way, and they are also scale independent. So they are nicely general, and they make the argument more robust. And the other thing is that the theorem allows you to say that if any amount of entanglement is observed between Q and Q primed, and of course M, Q and Q primed obey the two principles that I said earlier, then you can actually rule out all classical models for M, never mind whether they have already been conjectured or whether they will be conjectured in the future. So it just kind of says, well, if entanglement is observed, we really have to drop the idea that the gravity is classical. It won't do to modify slightly the laws, the classical laws that we have at the moment. And so that makes the argument more powerful than it would otherwise be. And in a similar vein, I think that what I wanted to point out is that there is a nice parallel here with something that I really like, a theorem that of course is at the foundations maybe of quantum information theory and of quantum theory in general, which is Bell's theorem. So in Bell's theorem is one of a kind in quantum information because it's not, of course, about quantum theory. So it's a theorem that is independent of the quantum formalism, and it allows us to say that if we manage to extract some statistics from an experiment and all the axioms of the theorem are satisfied, then these statistics, if they violate Bell's inequalities, then they have to be, they can't be described by local hidden variable models. So, you know, some classical world, some kind of classical notion is out of the way, is out of the, you know, you can't quite use it to describe the statistics. And so the fact that quantum theory violates Bell inequalities, of course, is very cool because it kind of tells us that it can be simulated by statistical models that are classical in you know, their foundation. But the theorem in itself is very powerful because, as I said, it just doesn't rely on specific assumptions about quantum theory or classical physics and so on. It's a more general type of argument. And this kind of argument that I just showed has a similar feature because it's also based on general axioms and it allows you to rule out a vast class of models for the mediator in the context of this thought experiment, much larger than what you could rule out if you just made specific predictions with the dynamical model for describing M, Q, and Q prime. And so in a sense, I think of this argument as the first instance of something that that one can prove in a very similar vein to the things that you can prove in quantum information theory, but beyond quantum theory. So you don't have to assume quantum dynamics to achieve the result. And so hopefully this is like the first step of a generalization of quantum information theory, which can take place within constructor theory. So to conclude, I think I've got some questions that I've already kind of keep discussing with some of my collaborators as well as you know, trying to kind of work them out myself. So the first one is really just a question that I have something that puzzles me, and I think presumably, you know, the answer is out there. I mean, there've been lots of thoughts, lots of people have expressed lots of thoughts about this issue of what constitutes an observable in GR. And in a sense, I'd like to understand in what sense, you know, when you understand gravity in this fundamental way through general relativity, to what extent this idea of copyability as the basis as a basic property for an observable can be extended, can be applied to gravity itself. So the other questions are more kind of specific. So of course the argument is agnostic as to what the incompatible variables of the mediator M should be. In case you manage to create this entanglement with Q and Q prime, there must be some incompatible variables for M, but it's not clear what they should be specifically. So it would be nice to know in different models of quantum gravity, even the non-perturbative ones, what are these incompatible variables that mediate the entanglement beyond, let's say, the standard linear quantum gravity model, which is what I think we use in order to make specific predictions about the experiment itself. And then, of course, the question is that there are other, there have been very nice new proposals for witnesses of non-classicality, like variants of this idea in order to witness non-classicality, let's say in gravity. And it would be nice to know if they too can be put into this general framework and made them more robust with this set of assumptions. And of course, I mean, the price sometimes you pay when you have a more general set of assumptions for an argument is that you end up maybe proving the argument in a qualitative version rather than in a quantitative version. And I think this is the case for the argument that I just discussed. But I think within the superinformation framework, you can actually make the argument fully quantitative. And I think that would be a very nice thing to do so that we can somewhat make a full correspondence between, let's say, the degree of entanglement that's created between Q and Q prime and the degree of incompatibility of the variables now expressed within the superinformation framework. So without using quantum theories type of tools in order to express the incompatibility, let's say, through non-commutativity. So I think this is the talk. And so I thank you for your attention. I'm very happy to take questions and have a discussion. Thanks. Yeah, cool. I'll stop the chat and I will wait. Here we go. Yeah.
Yeah, Lee, please go ahead.
Yes, it's a very beautiful argument. Thank you for the talk. How important is locality? When Carlo raised the issue of de Broglie-Bohm, I think that the way I would want to read it is if you have de Broglie-Bohm for two or more particles, for a single particle is trivial, but for two or more particles, ignore the fact that it doesn't fall into your categorization because it's not local. I think one would also be able to argue that it's non-classical on the terms of your definition. And I would argue that that's the more important thing.
Yes, I think, as I said, I like the questions and I think it would be nice to work out how to model, the non-locality in the Broglie-Bohm is one of a kind in a sense. So I think it would be nice to see whether the Broglie-Bohm violates this assumption in the sense that I mean in constructor theory. So that's already one thing that would be nice to check. Then the other thing is that, as you say, I think it should qualify as a superinformation medium. I mean, something that is described through the Broglie-Bohm. But I wouldn't know how to model within the Broglie-Bohm the kind of interaction that takes place in this experiment that I was discussing. So I think that's a nice question. I don't know the answer. And I would like to see whether the framework that I'm using can be helpful in order to clarify whether this can be modeled through the Broglie-Bohm.
I think one could. There are things that one can say one can't do in a de Broglie-Bohm configuration when it's entangled. There are local operations on one of the particles that one cannot make because it's entangled i.e. in a certain correlation with the other one, that would work also for de Broglie.
Yeah. Okay. I'm. You know, it's a nice question, and I'll think about it. It sounds fun.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Laurent has a question.
Hi, Kara. Yeah, I have a question about some our translation between your language of information, yes, that I'm not familiar with, and they say the things that you know I do in quantum gravity. So I hear when you say some words, I hear some other words, and I want to get a sense of whether it's the same, yes, thing or not. So for me, the you know I don't work with information theoretical tool. I work with non-commutative algebra as a way I think of, yes, of observable, of gravitational observable.
Yeah.
So when I'm interested by this idea of entanglement mediator and the incompatibility of entanglement medium or variable, right? So yes, the thing we do in quantum gravity, which is really the crucial thing steps today, is we're looking at this following problem. We're looking at, I want to replace entanglement medium by the boundary between two regions. So there's something we do, which is the following. We look at two regions which are entangled because they share a common boundary.
Yes.
So what I would call the entanglement media for me is replaced by the boundary of the algebra of observables, which is the mediator between these two objects.
Yes.
And then, so the incompatibility or compatibility of the variable for me is the try to define what is exactly the non-commutative structure of this algebra of boundary observable. Let's, yeah, say, you know, we can now show that this metric component does not commute with that metric component. Is that, yeah, what you have in mind? So can I, in the context of quantum mechanics, can I completely translate this notion of entanglement linear with algebra of observable with intersections or boundaries, and then compatibility with non-commutativity?
Yes, so I think the analogy, so I think what you just said is one way maybe of thinking about this mediator M. So I think what you said is exactly right. So the idea is that maybe I should just kind of describe a bit more the idea of the experiment itself. So the general thing is this, and I'll explain it in the case of electromagnetism, because it's maybe, I mean, at least for me, is more something I'm kind of more familiar with. So you can think of, let's say, two charges that, so to some degree, this applies, of course, also to some kind of linearized model of quantum gravity. So so you got these two charges that are the two quantum probes, Q and Q prime. And then when they are generated, they modified the field in a way that is kind of set by the field equations. And then these two masses or charges are put each into kind of a superposition of different locations. So they, let's say, you know, there's some, if you want to think of it in the Heisenberg picture, you can think of their observables evolving such a way that, you know, if initially one observable, which is position, is sharp, at a later time, the observable is no longer sharp. So each of them is superposed. And at that point, there is an always-on interaction with the field. So there is some kind of Lagrangian or Hamiltonian that describes this kind of interaction. And the terms in the interaction are such that a mass is coupled to the field directly, the other mass or charge is coupled to the field directly, but there is no direct interaction between the two masses. So there are no terms that couple directly the two, the observables of one charge and the other, but there's only, let's say, one charge coupled to the field observable, and likewise the other mass observables coupled to the field observable, but there are no direct terms of interactions between the first charge observables and the second charge observables. And then you will see that if you can generate entanglement between the two masses or charges, so if at a later time, you know, you start with them being in a, say, product state, and then at a later time, certain correlations, particular quantum correlations arise, which are basically the entanglement-like correlations. And if you, you know, if you look at what happened, is that the field mediated that entanglement. And the way in which this fits into what I just said is that the Hamiltonian for that describes this interaction has to involve non-commuting observables of the field. So, you know, you must have something like in the linear quantum gravity model or in let's say in quantum electron dynamics, you have to have something like the number operator and say something like A plus A dagger that in the Hamiltonian, which allow for this type of interaction to occur and for the entanglement to be generated. What I was trying to say now is that I wanted an argument which doesn't use a specific model to say that whenever I, you know, I got two charges, I don't know how they are interacting with a third system, which could be a field, but it could be something else. It could be the boundary that you were discussing, let's say. And if I start with them as being in a product state, and then finally I find them entangled, then if these axioms that I talked about are satisfied, then the algebra of observables, if you like, of this mediator have to include, I mean, can't be abelian, so it has to include things that don't commute. But this is now phrased in a more specific language, which is meaningful for quantum, let's say, field theory. But in the kind of stuff that I was discussing, I'm trying to be more general than that and trying not to talk about, you know, these specific formalisms. But I'm hoping that, did I answer your question? So I think what you said is exactly right in terms of modeling what I was talking about. It's just that I was trying to be more general and sort of discussing what a general argument for this witness of non-classicability could look like without having to specify to a specific formalism.
Okay, no, I see. That's very clarifying. There may be a difference there's something very specific about gravity that your description somehow does not include. That is,
yes,
that gravity is a frozen time formalism, which means that essentially the Hamiltonian is a constraint, which
yes.
means in a gravitational system, if it carries any amount of mass or energy, it is impossible, absolutely impossible to have a product state. So essentially it means that because the future of gravity is already encoded into the initial entanglement of the state, in some sense, if the Hamiltonian is a constraint, here you're describing the future of an interacting system is always entangled. But in a gravitational system, the future of a gravitational state is the same as the present. That's the in the sense that it's so there's something kind of drastically different, which the fact that you cannot anyway, you see what I'm saying is that in gravity, there is no such thing as a product state. They are always entangled. And that's yes. somehow, and the nature of that entanglement is the nature of the constraint. So that's why people, that's why we don't really talk about time evolution. We try to understand the nature of that entanglement from the get-go. So I don't know how that fit with this.
Yes, so let me.
There's no, in some sense, yeah.
I partly understand what you say, but let me just maybe clarify that.
What you're describing is good for quantum field theory, let's say.
But yes,
gravity is something really extraordinarily.
That's deep. Right. So I think one thing is to say is that the way in which we modeled, now aside from this argument that I described, I think the way the experiment itself was modeled in these papers that we wrote. Was using this very crude approximation of linear quantum gravity, which basically, as I said, makes the field look like it can behave in the same way as, say, the electromagnetic field when it interacts with two charges. So I think the treatment that we make is completely isomorphic with what you can do with two charges and you know, some background field which then interacts with them and mediates the entanglement between the two. Now, perhaps the product state language is not very fruitful. I use product state as wasn't very precise maybe, but so it's okay if there is some kind of entanglement mm-hmm. you know, in the initial state of, say, the two masses and the field. What one would want to measure is the fact that without the two masses interacting directly, so in other words, without there being a direct interaction term between these two charges or masses, the degree of entanglement between the two increases or changes with the dynamical interaction with the field. That's the kind of thing that we are looking for. So in a sense, you could have an initial state which is as entangled as you like, mm-hmm. but then you track some observables of the charges and you check that the degree of correlations through those observables has increased or changed in a way that you know, indicates a modification of the mutual entanglement between the two masses. And I think even in that case, you can you know, infer that the mediator has got to have some non-classical features in the sense that I said. In quantum information, we call this, quantum information doesn't apply here directly because we don't know how to treat gravity really in that framework. But if you just have a simple set of three quantum systems, and then you discover that you have somehow changed the degree of entanglement of two of them, you know that this can't have occurred by local operations only and classical communication. So that's one theorem that we have in quantum information. So somehow what I'm saying is maybe a generalization of that statement to this context where really we can't assume that gravity or whatever the mediator is obeys quantum theory, but we expect this fact still to be true. That if this object can somehow increase or change entanglement between two systems, it has to be non-classical. And I would be very interested to know if there is a way of understanding how to model this experiment more accurately from the point of view of gravity. I think that's something that I don't know how to do, but I would love to learn how to do that.
Yeah, that could be a beginning of a conversation for sure.
Yeah.
It seems like, I would like, anyway, I would like to understand.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, we can maybe continue. Thanks.
Okay. There is Hank with a question.
Yep. Hello.
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 We don't see you.
Yes. I guess I have two questions. First of all, when we were thinking about the De Broglie versus quantum mechanics, right?
Yes.
You sort of imposed this principle of locality to try to separate them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess among the set of these information variables, right, or rather information media, that can I interpret that as sort of imposing a topology on that set? Because we want to separate things, right? If that's the case, then...
Yes, sorry.
Sorry, did I not go through my question?
Yeah, no, sorry. I think there was a glitch in the communication. If you can just repeat the question.
Okay, of course. So basically, when we were thinking about the De Broglie versus quantum mechanics, you impose the principle of locality to separate these yep. two sort of theories. And I was just wondering, can we interpret, very generally, right? Can we interpret just assuming a certain set of principles, physical principles, as imposing a topology on the set of information media?
Yes, I think I should have said maybe that it's a nice point that so for all of these theorems to work, so because, you know, you might be wondering what kind of, I didn't write all of the assumptions that I use in, you know, to prove these results. But one key assumption that you need in order to formulate any theory in terms of constructor theory, so in terms of these possible and impossible tasks, is that the set of states or attributes of physical systems live in a space where there is a topology, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to to describe, to assign a meaning to what possible means. So you there has to be a system of, there has to be enough algebraic, enough structure to define at least a topology on this set of states.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Once you have that, then you can see what further requirements the various principles that we have in constructor theory, specifically these information principles, impose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a nice question, and from a mathematical point of view.
Yeah, and this, I guess this now ties to my, this sort of transforms my second question to a comment now, really, because I sort of confirmed it. So I guess this is very similar to what Urs Schreiber is doing, where he looks at physics from a very top-down mathematical point of view, from
yes.
the point of view of coherent topos.
Yes.
Category theory, basically, yeah. So just
wondering
your thoughts, yeah.
Yes, so the emphasis here is, so the emphasis that we are putting on this kind of approach is really on the physical content of these axioms or principles that we introduce in order to say, talk about information and other things that I haven't mentioned today. And it's possible, and I think I'm sure that there are lots of formal similarities with other things that I think are being done,
mm-hmm.
but somehow I would like to explore that further, because at the moment I think so far the focus for us was really to see what new physical predictions or consequences could you extract out of these principles,
right.
That I outlined. But yes, I think that's a nice comment that you made, and I can also maybe look into that and see whether there's any overlap in the formalisms or things of that kind, which could be very nice.
Right. Because I think the nice thing about using category theory is because you sort of built in the coherence relations. So the structure is very nice, nicely structured. So.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I agree with you. I think I've had a number of conversations with people who are interested in category theory, and there's of course some sense in which it looks like that would be the right formalism to express some of these theories, and probably they would be expressed in a much more elegant way than what we are doing here, because I'm basically using set theory and logic to kind of derive all of these statements.
Right.
So I think this is very promising, and I think I'd like to look into that. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Quick questions, because we're getting a bit late. Lee, Carlo, or who goes first?
Okay. Inside.
Go ahead, Lee.
Is one of your principles that it's impossible to move the center of mass of the universe? There's nothing that could move the center of mass of the universe.
So are you saying, do we have a principle like that, or that do our principles imply that? I wouldn't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. So can you say a bit more? Because I'm not sure the context.
Yes, Leibniz, arguing against Newton, made the claim that it could not be meaningful to have a physical transformation that moved the center of the universe 5 feet that way, or change the time of the universe 10 minutes to the past. And that was I think that was in the spirit of your constructive theory, and it ruled out Newtonian mechanics.
That's nice. I didn't know. So I think it's well, let me just say, the universe is something that we don't know how to treat as a substrate, because so that's, I think that's one comment I can make on what you just said. So I think in a sense it would be nice to it would be interesting to think of what possible means for a task defined on the whole of it, of the universe. And I The short answer is I don't know, but I would like to find out. So it sounds like it's a nice thing that I can look into.
This was supposed to be short, so.
But right. Okay. So but okay. So the short answer is the universe is a thing that is a special case of a substrate, but we don't know how to treat it as a substrate, and therefore watch this space. So at some point, maybe we'll be able to incorporate it into like, the notion of a substrate.
Good, thank you.
Okay, last question, Carlo.
I'm still confused about locality. Let me just make one point, because I think it came out confused, at least in your experiment, obviously you need locality to get the interpretation that you want. That
yes. Is not,
no classicality. And the reason you need locality is because otherwise the two masses can just affect one another directly without any gravitational field, without anything, and so then you don't.
Yes.
So you want that locality. Of course, locality means different things. You don't want that locality. And in fact, in your slides were very clear. I assume locality in the sense that there's no action at distance.
Yes.
But obviously, you do want locality in the sense of quantum mechanics, of EPR, because otherwise, the entire thing collapses.
Yes,
so, in your entire formalist postulates, assumption, principles, whatever, you do want non-locality in the sense of locality, so, right? Oh, wait,
yes.
wait. So,
okay.
I explain it to you. Now, the de Broglie-Bohm non-locality is EPR locality, is not the, sorry, is EPR non-locality, is the thing which is violated by the Bell inequalities non-locality. It's not the non-locality of action of a distance. So it's nothing to do with your locality axioms, the non-locality of de Broglie-Bohm.
Yes, so, first I have to clarify something to do with quantum theory. So. I think we agree, I don't know, but I hope we do, that from what you just said, I think we agree that Bell non-locality is unfortunately a very bad name, because...
It's the same non-locality that de Broglie-Bohm.
Well, no, I actually don't understand the particle. So there is this issue about the particles that are involved in using, in performing the predictions about the wave function in the Broglie-Bohm. The way in which they are used in order to then derive predictions about the wave function, which kind of behaves in the same way as quantum theory, has some issues with locality. And I think, Harvey has lots of papers about, so I think this is a very long discussion. It's not the same. And I think, well, we can discuss this maybe at some point if you like, offline, but I think just to kind of reassure you, forget about the Broglie-Bohm for a second. Yes, quantum theory is local in the sense of no action at a distance. This is obvious in the Isomer picture, and unfortunately, someone who was looking at Bell's theorem decided to say that that's a non-locality, that's a bad name for it. But locality, I mean, is really just the locality of quantum field theory. So if you have a way of interpreting the Broglie-Bohm so that if you take into account the whole of the ontology, you satisfy that, then I'm very happy to learn about it, and it just fits into the locality assumption, in which case the Broglie-Bohm stuff would be a super information medium and it's all fine. And I'm happy, if you can explain this to me at some point when we talk, that would be fun. But I think from some discussions I had with the Broglie-Bohm people, there was a sense in which the ontology of the Broglie-Bohm is problematic as far as that's concerned. I remember distinctly having discussions about this very principle and finding it problematic, but we can discuss about it. Also because, as I said, the locality principle that I'm requiring is very, it's a very basic principle in a sense, so it's nothing exotic. So it's important that you ask this question, because otherwise it would sound like I'm asking something very, very weird. But as I said, it's just what the good old quantum field theory requires, just maybe kind of in more general framework, but that's all.
If I may, just a comment. The De Broglie non-locality is much weirder than action at a distance. The particles are very unlike intuitive particles from classical theory. You can make lots of weird cases where there are boxes and there's a De Broglie bone particle here and it bounces off the De Broglie bone particle in the other box very far away.
I'm not saying whether it's reasonable or not. I'm asking in which sense, what De Broglie bone...
It is a real non-locality.
According to this definition, it's just a question. I'm not asking whether it's reasonable or not. It doesn't have non-commuting variables. But is it classical or quantum?
Sorry, say it again. It doesn't have non-commuting
variables.
So it's not an easy answer because it's not clear how to... first of all, the Broglie bone has other things other than the quantum state. If it were just the quantum state, then it would be unitary quantum mechanics, and I would know how to answer the question. But if you bring in the other stuff, the particles, then first of all, I don't know whether I can define whether they have information variables in the sense that I say. And clearly they don't, because they're not directly detectable.
Is a wave... The hidden variable is a wave. The particle are detectable.
No, I understand that. But how do you describe a process of measurement? And so all of these questions have to be addressed in order to say which are the copyable things. So, as I said, I don't know the answer to your question because I haven't thought of the Broglie bomb in the sense of information variables. As I said, it's a nice question. I don't know if the non-locality that I was discussing earlier about, that arises in the Broglie bomb affects the definition of information variables in any way. I'd like to know about that. And as I said, maybe if you know more about the theory, it would be nice, even to kind of discuss this offline. But why are you, I'm curious, sorry, just one more thing, whether... what is it about the Broglie bomb that you find?
It's a way for me to understand what you mean by quantum. I don't understand what you mean by quantum. I don't have a grasp of what you mean by quantum.
The way is quantum theory?
No, I know quantum theory, but I know many versions of quantum theory. And you have
all of them agree on certain phenomenology, so you can say. Okay.
It cannot be just existing on non-commuting things. There should be or copyability. Maybe I haven't understood what copyability is.
So let me just for the sake of clarifying. I think so. One thing that was in that slide was quantum systems, and by quantum systems I mean systems that obey unitary quantum mechanics.
No, but
Schrödinger equation and Heisenberg equation of motion. Whether or not you want to add an ontology to that, I don't mind. I'm just really thinking of something that obeys unitary quantum theory. I'm not thinking of collapse. I'm not thinking of stuff that is like, you can interpret quantum mechanics, unitary quantum mechanics in various ways, but I'm just thinking of something that really obeys the laws of quantum theory as they are with no modifications. Then there was this thing called superinformation media, which is like a class of systems that have some copyable variables. And these copyable variables are behaving a special way because if you put them together and you take the union of them, then you can't copy them anymore. Now, quantum systems have this feature, but other systems may too. And now I think your question was, if I take the Broglie bomb theory, version of quantum theory, if you like, where does it fit into your framework? Does it fit in the super information framework? The answer is I don't know, because I don't know if it satisfies locality in the way I want, and I don't know if how to define how to identify these information variables beyond what I can obviously identify by considering the quantum behavior that the Broglie bomb can simulate. That's the answer to the question. I don't know, is this a bit more clear? Slightly? Okay.
I think we can, if you continue this maybe privately, and we should probably thank Chiara again.